Hello, everybody. How's it going? Welcome back to the History of Video Games. My name is Wes, and I'm here, as always, with the wonderful Ben. How are you doing today, Ben?
I'm doing great. How are you, Wes?
I am doing good. Feeling refreshed. We just had a little bit of a break. Took a little break from recording the podcast for a sec, and ready to go, you know?
Yep, it was Thanksgiving in the U.S. over here. And we had some time off, and I definitely played a lot of games. I'm assuming you played some games.
I played a lot of a few games, yeah.
Okay, you want to get us started with what you've been playing?
Sure, yeah. Yeah, because I'm, you know, still taking a break from Baldur's Gate 3, which gets more dangerous by the day, but I'll never go back and complete it. But
right. Well, you have to.
I have to, absolutely. And I heard there are a couple bugs with their most recent update, so I'm okay waiting it out for a little bit more. But I was going back through to games that I've, you know, picked up, started, and wanted to complete. And what I settled on is finishing my playthrough of Mass Effect 3 from the Legendary Edition that I bought.
Okay.
Which Legendary Edition, if you don't know, is they kind of re-released and remastered Mass Effect 1, 2, and 3 and released them as a bundled package with all of their DLCs, except for one DLC for Mass Effect 1 where the code has been lost. And in my playthrough of it, I was pretty early on in the third game in Mass Effect 3, and it's a beloved RPG of mine. I love space, and Mass Effect 2 is probably my favorite, so I think I've actually only played all the way through Mass Effect 3 once before, but I'd never played any of the DLCs because I bought it right when it came out, finished it within probably a couple weeks, and then didn't feel like paying money for all the like story stuff. So it's been really fun going back and playing all the DLCs that I didn't do before. One of them adds a new squad mate who is a, not like I need to avoid spoilers for this game, but is a member of a race that was previously thought to be extinct. So having him on your party is very interesting because he has a totally different perspective. And like people have been studying his race's culture for years, and some of them are a little shocked by what someone from that species is actually like. So that's a lot of fun. I've been bringing him on a fair bit of missions. There's also a big one where you learn about the origins of the Reapers, which are the big bad guys of the games. That's the Leviathan DLC. That one was a little weird. Like the story I was really into, but the gameplay, it just felt like they tried to do something new for Mass Effect 3 and it just didn't fit with what Mass Effect 3 is. You know, it's a third-person shooter RPG. You have powers and a squad and stuff like that. And they tried to do like this detective sort of thing where you're in this lab and you have to inspect different objects and then run like a search filter based off the stuff that you find to find out what planet to go to. But what it amounted to is just sprinting around the lab, mashing the space bar to examine stuff. Like, it didn't feel like I was investigating. It felt like, I know there's a certain amount of buttons I have to click in this room, so let me run around until I click all the buttons. I don't know. Maybe that was my approach to it, but that left me wanting a little bit. But the final sequence of that DLC is very epic and cool and has interesting sort of ramifications for the story of the whole game. And then the third DLC, which I played, there's still one more left that I haven't played, but the third DLC, Omega, I really enjoyed because it takes you back to one of the really fun areas in Mass Effect 2, Omega, this like lawless asteroid base ruled by a lady named Arya, and you get to go back there and basically retake it from occupying forces, and you get two temporary squad mates who aren't in the whole rest of the game, Arya herself and then another mystery one. So that was very fun, having like two squad mates that you never get to play with before. Unfortunately, you don't take them after, but still, that story was really cool. Felt pretty personal to the character, which was nice because I like that character a lot. And yeah, it was a lot of fun. And so I'm nearing kind of the end of Mass Effect 3 now, I think. Okay. The last DLC I have to do, I was reading and people said it's kind of best to save it for last. It's the Citadel DLC. It's basically just the fan service DLC. Even though the world and the whole entire galaxy, in fact, is about to end, they found a way to give you a DLC where like you just spend a couple weeks in an apartment with all the companions hanging out. And that's like most of the DLC, I think, just like hilarious cutscenes. I think there is some combat to kind of you know, tie it together. But I'm looking forward to that because I love the characters in the Mass Effect series. So any excuse for funny dialogue and stuff like that, I'm all in for.
Okay, cool. Yeah, that's such a good series. I think I've played all three.
Nice.
But it's been a couple years.
Yeah, yeah.
I'll definitely have to revisit them sometime. I definitely haven't played, I don't think, any of the DLC. So.
Yeah. Well, yeah, and if the Legendary Edition goes on sale, I mean, the first game looks a fair bit better, and you get all the DLCs tied in with it. So,
yeah,
definitely a good time to get back into it.
Yeah, man. I think, just like you, I think 2 was my favorite when I was playing through before.
Absolutely. Yeah,
they're all great. All right, that's exciting.
Yeah, for sure. But what have you been playing recently?
Yeah, over Thanksgiving break, I actually beat 3 games. Some of them are pretty short. And the one I want to talk to you about today, I'm kind of doing it a bit out of order, but I think it's going to make sense later when I talk about some other things. So the one I wanted to talk about today is I ended up going back to my Tom Clancy games. As you know, I got a Humble Bundle with a bunch of them, and I needed to play a bunch. And I've played Rainbow Six, and I played some Splinter Cells, and it was finally time for me to dip my toes into Ghost Recon, which is the other big franchise, right? Yeah. And I didn't know anything about Ghost Recon other than there was like a number of games that were Ghost Recon games. And I kind of thought going into it, it would be more like a Call of Duty type game or something. But I was quickly surprised when I loaded it in. And the game is pretty much just Rainbow Six again.
Yeah.
At least this first one. I mean, the time to kill is like one bullet and then you're dead. And just like in Ghost Recon, you're leading a team. In this case, it's a team of 6 soldiers divided into 3 squads. In Rainbow Six, you had 8 soldiers for 4 squads, so slightly smaller squad size. I think one of the main differences is that in Rainbow Six, there was this whole like pre-planning phase where you could kind of plan out the routes every squad would take and like when they stop moving and like what command you need to issue for them to move in again. But on this one, I guess they wanted you to feel like, you know, you are on the ground as a soldier and you had to create the plan
right
as it was happening, right? So there's still like a planning kind of panel, but the game doesn't pause when you're in it and you're kind of issuing these commands as the action is happening, I guess. Which sounds cool, but honestly, what ended up happening in this game, unlike in Rainbow Six, which the theming there is like you against terrorists, and there's a lot of like protect the hostages and charge into a room from 3 angles at the same time. In Ghost Recon, it's a lot more like you're a soldier on the front lines of a war who does like spec op stuff. So all the maps were a lot larger, with a lot more sight lines, you know, you could see people really far away. And to me, that just meant, okay, use the sniper and try to see people before they see you and just start sniping fools. And I must have racked up hundreds of sniper kills. And I pretty much just went in solo and just had the other teams just kind of behind me in case, I don't know, 10 people stormed out of a building at me, you know, they could take them down then. But for the most part, I played the game solo. It was really hard because the time to kill is so high, and some of the optional objectives involved like not having a lot of casualties and stuff. So luckily there was a quick save and quick load feature in the game, and I just used that a lot. But the game, I don't know. Otherwise, it was pretty much just like a Rainbow Six game. It felt like I feel like the characters were just pulled from Rainbow Six and the animations and the UI design and the gun models and stuff. But I thought the story on this one was much worse than the Rainbow Six games.
How old is the one that you played? Do you know?
I think it's 2001.
Okay. Yeah.
Something like that.
I've played some of them and had a decent time with them, but I'm curious if maybe, you know, early on, very similar, but hopefully they'll kind of each have their own identity as they branch off.
I hope so, because I was kind of not impressed with it. Yeah, I believe they made this game only a year after Rainbow Six. I'm double checking it now, but it came out, like, all these games came out at the same time, pretty much. But I don't know why they wouldn't have just called it, like, Rainbow Six Ghost Recon, because that's what it is. Yeah, Rainbow Six came out in 98, and then this came out in 2001. And Rainbow Six 2 that I played came out in 99. So it's like all around the same time, pretty much.
Right.
They were just pumping them out, man. But yeah, it's pretty much the same thing. It just felt, but you know, the theming was slightly different and how you issued the commands was a little different because you're kind of in the game doing it, like in the mission. It wasn't a pre-planned thing, but it felt very similar. And by now I've played so many Rainbow Six games that I was pretty good at it, I thought. So it wasn't too hard. It was only 15 missions, I want to say. And again, I thought the story on this one wasn't interesting, because in the first Rainbow Six, the story was like, there's a mastermind pulling off these terrorist attacks, and there was a character there that you were hunting, right? But in this one, it was like, there is a war going on between the US and Russia. Go in and blow up a bridge. Go in and blow up a tank. Go in and blow up a submarine. There's no bad guy. There's no, you really did anything.
Yeah,
you're just playing your part in this war, you know, that's commanded by people you don't need to know about, I guess.
Hmm. Interesting. Yeah. Yeah. I could see that being a little removed and boring.
Yeah. It wasn't really what I was looking for, but it wasn't bad. Like, I still enjoyed it. I just feel like just play Rainbow Six instead. Like, I really enjoyed the first game, and even the sequel I thought was good. So I'd say this is like third on the list for me. But hopefully they do change it up going forward. I don't know. We'll find out.
Yeah.
I have a lot to do.
Yeah, I'm curious to hear as you play more of them, because I know, I mean, it could be the rose-colored shades of nostalgia, but some that I used to play on the Xbox, I absolutely loved. So,
yeah. Do you know, were they still, you know, very quick time to kill kind of games, or was it more like a, for some reason I was thinking Ghost Recon was more like a Call of Duty type franchise, but
no,
maybe it's definitely, I was just misremembering,
always like kind of tactical squad based, but
okay,
there's like more close quarters in a lot of the ones I play, or no, you know what, I'm thinking of Rainbow Six. Yeah, I don't know, I think it's mainly the squad command on like a large scale that and like in a large environment that kind of defines it, so I don't know.
Yeah.
We'll see. Yeah.
Yeah, well, by the way, on I've been trying to play the DLCs for these when I do them, but I wasn't able to get the Ghost Recon DLCs running, so I'm just going to move on with that one.
Yeah, I think that's fair.
Yeah. But yeah, that's one of the games I played.
Cool.
This past weekend.
Well, I'm excited to hear about some more of them next week, but for now, we've got a special topic to get to today. An exciting one that I don't think we really saw coming until you started looking through an issue of Byte Magazine, Ben. But there is a new language coming out that's actually been a programming language that's been worked on for a while, but this is its first public release, and Byte Magazine for August had a whole issue dedicated to it and this release, and it's called Smalltalk. Specifically, Smalltalk 80 is this release, and apparently, Smalltalk is still around today, and it can refer to a large number of languages. So we're specifically going to be talking about Smalltalk 80 today. I believe they, at the beginning, named them based off the year when it was like finalized, and this is coming out in 81, but this is the 1980 version. And this was publicly released and designed by the Palo Alto Research Center, who we just recently talked about developing GUI, like GUI interfaces and all that, and tons of other cool tech that Xerox wasn't really taking advantage of, because Xerox technically ran the Palo Alto Research Center. But this they actually did take some interest in, thankfully, and it is a pretty cool programming language. It's an object-oriented programming language, which means basically, like, I don't know much about programming, but as far as I know, the overview is you can refer to objects, which are things that contain data and code, by using like specific phrases. So instead of being down in the weeds, it kind of simplifies things and gives you, you can more easily access different things and run certain programs and things like that. And some examples of current day object-oriented languages are C++ and Java.
Some pretty big ones.
Yes. Yeah, yeah. And I think ease of use is kind of a big part of that type of programming language. Mm-hmm. But getting back to the development of Smalltalk, it was developed by many people over a long period of time. But in the early days, it was mainly led by a guy named Alan Kay. The first iterations of Smalltalk were created all the way back in 1971, and they were just being developed internally at Xerox and not shared outward. Also, I found that several women helped in the development of this language too, which is awesome. Always good to see the points in history where women have made a huge contribution. And one particular one who I'm going to talk about a little bit is Adele Goldberg, who wrote most of the documentation for Smalltalk. And the basic idea behind the Smalltalk language was to have a language that worked by having objects send messages to each other as a way of communicating and like running programs through a virtual machine that was run on a computer. I know in theory what that means, but practically I have no idea what that means. But it was a way of kind of an innovative way of getting code to run and allowing people to make more complex programs, I would think, and also allowing it to be more accessible to the user. And so it was initially designed to be a coding learning tool because of its ease of use, but it grew popular once it was released and businesses started using it a lot too. And it also had a built-in development environment, which is really cool. I mean, it basically looked like you're running a word processor or like a notepad, and they must have been using the GUI technology that they'd already developed there, because you could do things like search for commands and terms within it, so you know like how to define certain objects, which is crazy to think about when you think like at the same time we have people typing up stuff in assembly language with no guidelines. This must have made things much easier and more streamlined. But since Xerox finally realized that one of these ideas coming out of Palo Alto Research Center was good, they decided to distribute this, and the first version came out in 1981 and was distributed to Apple, DEC, HP, and Tektronix to help proliferate the language basically and get it on a bunch of different computers. And in the Byte magazine issue that was dedicated just to Smalltalk and a couple different versions of it, there was this really great section written up by Adele Goldberg where she references a 1978 version of Byte about the introduction of the Pascal language. And in that issue, apparently the editor compared the coding languages to like different bodies of water. He said like the calm sea of Pascal because it was so easy to code in. And they knew about Smalltalk at that point. So they said Smalltalk was a kingdom on top of a mountain that didn't interact with the rest of the world. So on this cover, Adele Goldberg referenced that. And she said, well, that's why we're now in this hot air balloon so we can actually spread Smalltalk to the rest of the world. And I just thought it was funny that she's like, hey, we're actually talking to other people now for the full release.
Cool.
Yeah. So the basic overview that I got from reading about it, I don't know a ton about coding languages, so I might butcher this, but based on the images shown in Byte magazine, it just makes it look like Smalltalk has its own GUI that makes it incredibly easy to use. And at a time where the internet didn't exist, I feel like being able to search the meaning of terms in this coding language on your own machine instead of digging through the manual must have been pretty huge. So I'm excited to see what people do with this.
Oh, yeah. I've got a couple things I'd like to add.
Yeah.
I first kind of learned about this language partly from the Byte article, but also I was looking up into this other computer Xerox just released called the Xerox Star, which is a new computer for us. We haven't talked about it before. It is, they say it's a personal computer, but they costed like $5,000 to $10,000 and were mainly sold to businesses. But they actually came with Smalltalk installed alongside the Lisp language. But it was the first computer to ever be like commercially sold with Smalltalk and kind of like with a GUI and a mouse and all this stuff. Because you have to imagine up until this point, we've pretty much just been dealing with like programming via command prompt. If you guys are aware of that on your computers, I mean, it's all text based. There's no mouse. There's no cursor. And I was just blown away because I opened up this Byte article, which it's like the whole magazine. The magazine's like 500 pages long. It's ginormous. But there's like literally screenshots of here, and they're talking about, like, you know, a cursor is what the mouse pointer is pointing at. It's like, it's defining the most basic things that we would understand today. It's like, this is what a window looks like. You're like, oh right. My God, it's happening, you know? And it was just, it's crazy reading through this, because they're like, to select a word, push the mouse button down and then hover over the word and it'll select it. And you're like, oh my God, they thought about that. Honestly, it just feels like they're describing Notepad or Microsoft Word in this thing. Like, there's options for copy, cut, paste, undo. It's everything you can think of. Inserting. They talk about deleting words quite a bit. They're like, you know, if you highlight something and start typing, it'll get rid of it. Like, really, you need a whole paragraph to like explain that, you know what I mean? So it's just absolutely insane to look at. And honestly, it doesn't look that different from what we have now, especially Notepad, I would say. It's interesting how they, as you mentioned, it kind of interacts through objects with other things. So they had an example of like sending an email, and it was pretty much like you write up the email in Notepad or something, and then like you have to send a command to like the email script that takes those words and then sends them or something, you know? But it was not like that was a separate program. Like, everything's happening in these little windows, which are all kind of text-based panels, at least in this article. So it's very, very interesting. And we've never seen anything like it on the podcast, so we had to talk about it because it's so weird.
Yeah.
And I did double check, by the way. I was looking into like the first ever Windows operating system. Right, that was apparently based off of a different program, but that other program was based off of Smalltalk.
Oh, okay.
And I believe Apple, you know, like when Steve Jobs saw the GUI interface at Park, he was looking at Smalltalk. So although they didn't use that programming language, it was the inspiration behind everything. It's just amazing how many features they have here that you would associate with more modern processes, you know? Like, yeah, you would think absolutely. The first version of Windows would only be able to type or something, but like, there is a whole part of the article about having the windows be overlappable. They said they wanted it to feel like pieces of paper on a desk, where some of the windows can overlap each other and they're not forced to close one out to open another and stuff like that. Like, so many just great features that we still see today. Yeah, yeah, I think sure. Like, the design concepts are the types of ideas that people are still shooting for today. Like, intuitive design, it's all here. So yeah, it's pretty cool. And definitely have to mention Smalltalk. I'm sure we will see it again, although we probably not talk about the Xerox Star again, because that doesn't really do anything. I don't still understand how Xerox is selling computers at such a high price point.
Yeah,
considering they're one of the largest companies in the world at this point.
Businesses must be buying them or something. I don't know.
Yeah, so the Xerox Star introductory price was apparently $16,595, which is equivalent to $53,000 in 2022.
Nice. Buy a car for that.
That's crazy.
Oh, man.
Well, but cool. I guess it's cheaper than the Alto. The Star was apparently like the new version of the Alto, just so you know.
Okay. Yeah, so at least they're making slight improvements, but not yeah. something that we're going to see a lot of stuff for.
True. All right, with that being said, though, I think we'll take a break, head into some games into the timeline section, and it'll be a good time. We'll be right back. Hello and welcome back. We're going to hop into the games today. We're actually in August of 1981. We just got to August beginning this episode. So the first games in August that we wanted to talk about were some Game & Watch games. We've got Game & Watch Popeye,
ooh,
which was also released in other languages I'm not going to try to pronounce. But yeah, this was an actually licensed Popeye game. I think it's the first one ever.
Yeah.
There's also a weird Smarties branded edition of this. Like Smarties is in the candy.
Oh, okay.
I don't know why or how, but it was. But it's a normal Game & Watch game that's mostly just like a timing-based juggling type game. We have an exact date of August 5th, 1981 for this release.
Yeah, and cool to see that Nintendo finally got to make a game with that Popeye licensing, since they were originally hoping to do that with Donkey Kong, but that kind of took its own life and went in a different direction.
Mm-hmm.
But we also do have some clones for Game & Watch Popeye. Most of them just called Popeye, but by companies like CGL, Futuretronics, Pocket Size, Trickatronic, and a couple more that you can see on our website.
Lots of clones. All right, but let's move into some computer games quick. This first one is called Kido Senshi Gundam. This one's interesting. It's actually from a magazine, a Japanese magazine called ASCII Magazine, which we have never talked about on the podcast because it's in Japanese and I can't read it. But it has been going in Japan. And this game somehow we've heard about from the magazine, mainly because it seems to be the first ever Gundam game to exist. And it's from this magazine. It seems to be some sort of turret gunning game that we've seen before, but Gundam's such a very, you know, famous anime mech franchise, so we had to include it. And this was actually for the PC 8001, which is a small computer for us, but maybe it was more popular in Japan.
All right, and then we have a game called Beer Run by Mark Turmel and Sirius Software. And it's a platforming game, almost like Donkey Kong, where you're kind of like catching beer and dodging obstacles. That's pretty cool. It was a weird one. Has some crazy theming, and it was for the Apple II.
And then next up, we've got one called Deflex 5 by Jeff Minter and Llamasoft. Some of you guys who are old school might know Jeff Minter. We're going to be talking about him a lot. He's got like, I don't know, 50 games to his name. He's pretty popular in the old school community. But this was his first game, and it was for the VIC-20 and the Commodore PET. And it's just like a deflection type game that we've seen before, so this one's not too interesting, but some of his later ones will be, and he's known for some pretty crazy themings, especially if he names his company Llamasoft.
I bet. Yeah, looking forward to it. I mean, you gotta start somewhere, right?
Yep.
All right, and then we have one here called Rocket Raiders by Artworks and Dynacomp, and it's actually a pretty good version of Missile Command that was harder, it was faster, and had more of a city to defend. All sounds very interesting, and it was for the Atari 8-bit.
And then next up, we've got another game for the Epic Cassette Vision, which just released last month, and released like two episodes ago for us. But this game was not part of the original launch lineup. It came out in August. We actually have an exact date of August 10th, 1981, and it's Galaxian for the system. A pretty good one to include, which so far, they've got Galaxian, Baseball, and Yosaku.
What a lineup.
I know, quite the lineup. But, you know, we play a lot of Galaxian games, so I don't think we need to play this one. But, you know, it was a decent Galaxian.
Nice, yeah. Have to have it.
Yeah.
All right, but now let's move into our first review of the day. This one's really weird, and I was excited to take a look at it. It is a arcade game called Armored Car by Stern Electronics, the makers of Berserk. Not related at all to Berserk. I just like to remind people that they made that.
Because they haven't really made anything else that's of note, really.
No, I feel like that's their big one. Maybe Armored Car is going to knock that off the pedestal. Probably not.
Okay.
But it's an interesting one. And when I was looking up a little bit of history about it, it was developed in part by Chris Oberth, who OG longtime fans of the podcast might remember a long time back made an Apple II game called 3D Docking Mission. I don't know why I remember that, but cool to know that this guy's working with Stern now.
Yeah.
So maybe we'll see some more Chris Oberth games in the future from Stern. The Wikipedia stated for this that it was inspired by Targ by Exidy, which makes a lot of sense. I know, Ben, you also mentioned that it reminds you a lot of New Rally X, and I think probably both of those had an influence on this game because it's a top-down driving game on a grid, and unlike Targ, but like New Rally X, it has scrolling only to the right in this one, but it does have scrolling. The cabinets looked pretty simple, unfortunately, just a lot of wood grain and red and black checkered patterns all over the place. So not too much going on there, and we don't know too much history about it, but it is an interesting game, so let me get into it and talk about it a bit. Armored Car is a game where you have to drive through a grid-based city, and it's like an equal, it's a grid, it's not a track in the way that New Rally X is, where it has kind of variations, it's all the same. But you play as the armored car, and you have to collect money and deliver it to banks along the way, or the Federal Reserve at certain checkpoints. And of course, there are lots of obstacles in the way. You can't just be an armored car, drive straight to the bank, and have a happy day. There are directional arrows that appear at intersections in the road, and you have to follow whatever direction they're going. So it'll either be horizontal or vertical. So those can kind of block your available paths. And while your path is getting blocked, there are also criminal cars that can chase you down, and if they run into you, they blow you up. You have a limited number of sawhorses, which are like, you know, those kind of wooden standing up roadblock things with the orange lines across them, if you don't know what a sawhorse is. And you can deploy them to block an intersection, and you get points if one of the criminal cars hits it and explodes. You also have a fuel meter that drains as you move. But interestingly, when your fuel goes down to zero, the game doesn't end. You just can't boost and your car moves slower. And so there are gas station like power-ups, basically. It just says gas on it that you can pick up along the way, and they refill your tank up to full. And you also get a full tank every time that you make it to the bank and deposit your money. And when you go to the bank to deposit money, you also get sawhorses based on how much money you collected. And I forgot to mention it, but the sawhorses you can deploy are limited, kind of like a bomb in like a shooting game or something. The game scrolls to the right, and you can move your car in any direction, and a camera actually pans to follow you if you go towards the left, but it's always moving a little bit to the right. So like if you double back, eventually the whole entire left side of the screen gets covered in directional arrows, so it's basically impassable. So you kind of have a little bit of wiggle room with like what side of, if there's a little bit of the left side of the screen still on screen, you can double back there and get some money that you missed or anything like that. But eventually as the screen continues to pan, you're going to lose some of that. So you're always working to the right, but you can still move in every single direction as you're going through this grid, picking up money, dodging directional signs and cars, and the occasional later enemies that show up, like the street sweeper, which I think kills you, but it just goes in a straight line. It also sweeps up the sawhorses, the steamroller, which goes like 100 miles an hour, which is impressive for a steamroller, and just in a straight line runs you over. And then eventually TNT trucks that chase you down and explode when the criminals are getting really desperate.
Yep.
But yeah, so all that's going on, you're ducking, weaving through this grid, picking up little dollar signs on the road, getting as much as you can without, you know, slowing down and running out of fuel and getting caught, and then depositing it at the bank. And it looks like every 5 banks you go to is a Federal Reserve, and you get an extra life when you go there, and you start with 3 lives. So it's a really interesting game, but a lot of concepts that we've seen before, it kind of, I feel like, ties together Targ, New Rally X, and Pac-Man with the dodging of the criminal cars, because they can chase you in any direction. They don't go in straight lines like the street sweepers. But with that, let me get into my ratings for this game. For graphics, I gave it a 3 out of 10. It has a very strange aesthetic going on. I mean, it just kind of feels, I don't know, it looks a little weird. But I'm so thankful that even though it's a grid-based game and everything looks kind of like strange and cartoonish, the grids aren't just solid colors. You know, there's actually little top-down views of like groups of buildings and stuff in the squares that kind of make up the grid. So that's really nice. Gives it a city feel. They don't look fantastic, but it's much better than Targ. So I'm thankful for that. The cars, including yours, just look all right. but there's still a decent amount of color. The part I don't like is that it's also filled with empty space that the black background just kind of fills in. But some of the cars do change color periodically, which is nice, gives it some nice visual distinction. And the sawhorses actually look surprisingly good. I mean, despite the very specific name, as soon as I saw it, I was like, okay, yeah, I know exactly what that is. So I really like the sprite for those. And my favorite sprite has to be the street sweeper, which actually has an animation of two spinning lines that kind of look like brushes sweeping in front of it as it goes. The bank building also looks decent, but I was really disappointed that the money that you're picking up throughout the whole entire game is just a dollar sign instead of the classic like sack of money. I feel like that would have been so much better.
Mm-hmm.
So some good and bad, but overall, I think it still looks pretty good. There's a lot going on screen. The explosions look pretty good. Everything moves pretty smoothly, even when you're boosting your car. So yeah, all looks pretty decent. Moving on to sounds now, I only gave it a 2.5 out of 10 here. The sounds in this game are interesting, but I feel like I do have to dock some points because there's just no music at all. I think the armored car movement and boost sounds are pretty good, the engine noises. I also like the explosion noises all right, and the warning indicator beep for when you're low on fuel isn't that abrasive, so that was a plus for me. The scoring beeps for picking up money are also satisfying. And I was okay with the weird high-pitched horn noise that almost sounds like a traffic cop whistle that I don't know why it happens, but it happens occasionally. So there's a lot of decent sounds in this, but none of them are particularly interesting and there's no music, so I couldn't rate it too high. Now let's talk about the gameplay, and I was really excited about this because I actually really enjoyed this game. I didn't think I was going to have such a good time with it, but I ended up giving it a 3.5 out of 10. My initial impression was, what the hell is going on with this game, when I watched a video on it, because it's just a lot on screen, but it is a lot of fun. It's a great blend of the maze games that we've seen before, but it has sort of that Pac-Man cat and mouse in it as well. And I love the strategy of plopping the sawhorses down in the intersections to catch the enemy cars. I really like that you have plenty of reason to go backwards a little bit if you like miss a dollar sign tucked away in a corner. And, you know, it feels fun ducking in and out of these city streets in the grid to collect money and dodging the enemy cars. I also like all the different obstacle types, from the directional arrows to the street sweepers to the steamrollers. It just gives you a lot to think about. And one of the things I like the most is probably the fuel mechanic. I just really appreciate that running out of fuel isn't an instant loss. I feel like so many games, that's just how it works. And it's really fun that it's just a handicap for your speed, because it motivated me to like use my fuel as much as I could without worrying about running out as much. So I feel like I got to take more risks because of that, ended up in more interesting situations. And yeah, it was just a lot of fun. And after watching some people play this on an actual cabinet, it definitely seems like there's a lot of room to be like crazy good at this game. If you maximize your fuel, you know where the enemies spawn and all that. So I love that there's kind of that skill gaining potential to it. Yeah, so overall, just kind of, it was satisfying and a lot of fun to just duck and weave in this car, zoom all over the place and trap the enemies. So I had a lot of fun with that. Moving on to relevance, I gave it a 6 out of 10. It's always nice to see another game from Stern, but as I said at the beginning, Berserk is kind of their big one, and I don't think Armored Car is going to be their next huge hit. It's unique and a lot of fun, but I have a feeling a lot of these gameplay ideas aren't going to stick around because they don't seem that familiar to me. So not super relevant, and overall that left me with a 3.25 out of 10. Armored Car is surprisingly fun. Had decent graphics and okay sounds, but really unique and addicting gameplay. I played it 3 times even when I didn't have to play it that much, you know, and it definitely had that one more time feeling playing it. So yeah, it's a cool one, really unique.
Nice, man. Yeah, I mean, I think it looks pretty cool. I didn't realize you were playing as the good guy originally. Yes. When I first saw it, I thought you were stealing from the banks.
That's what I thought at first too, because the cars kind of look like cop cars that are chasing you.
Yeah.
But the more I played it, I'm like, oh no, you are the armored car and you're depositing in the bank. Yeah.
Cool. I don't know, the grid based like kind of city feel, I'm just thinking, oh my god, it's like GTA. No. I think we're a little away from that, but you know what I think, you know.
We're getting there.
Like driving through the city grid, you know?
Oh yeah, yeah, absolutely.
All right, but let's move on. We've got a couple other big ones here, some big arcade games. This next one is one that I took a look at. It's called Naughty Mouse, and it's by Amenip, I'm going to say. I don't know. And also published by Palcom Queen River, who I think just did a port of it. And this is like a Donkey Kong / Pac-Man / Space Panic type game. If you guys don't remember Space Panic, we did do a full write-up on it. It's like the title of one of our episodes, but it was kind of like before Donkey Kong, a game where you climbed ladders, and it was kind of had some Pinocchio alien vibes where you kind of like dug out parts of the floor and enemies would fall in. And the ladders make a big return in this game. Basically, in this game, you play as a mouse. And we've played other Naughty Mouse games in the past. But on this one, there's not much naughty about it. It's just a mouse who is, I guess, trying to steal eggs. I don't really know. Basically, on screen, you're looking at a bunch of platforms connected by ladders. There's, I think, bird eggs scattered around the level that you have to go to. And when your guy gets there, the eggs become bird houses. So I guess you're protecting them? I don't know.
Okay.
Weirdly enough, you can actually make the eggs break open and you see all these like baby bird faces come out of the eggs. And when that happens, you instantly die. So I don't know what's going on. But yeah, it seems like the goal is to build bird houses in this game and basically dodge enemy birds, which are basically act like Pac-Man ghosts. And they try to follow you and chase you. Their AI is a little all over the place. Sometimes they just kind of walk around and don't really do anything. Other times they're definitely chasing you. And the mouse that you're playing reminds me an awful lot of the Chuck E. Cheese mouse, if I'm being honest, but he's red. But yeah, the game is basically like a cat and mouse, like Pac-Man style dodging game tied with like climbing up and down ladders and different platforms like you would see in Space Panic or maybe that first level of Donkey Kong. So that's what the game is, and it's pretty weird. But I definitely wanted to take a look at it because just the graphics alone are pretty incredible on this. But the thing that really threw me for a loop is, for one thing, the difficulty. I don't know what it's been lately, but we've just been playing a lot of hard games lately, I feel like. Yeah. And on this one, I could not beat the first level. Like, I've tried over and over, and I just could not beat it. I don't know. I kept getting cornered, because there's more than one, like, ghost, you know, like the enemy bird on screen, and they can come from two angles, and you just, like in Pac-Man, there's always, like, corners you can go to, right, that kind of have maybe a four-way intersection, and one of those four ways, there's not a ghost there. But when it's just like two ladders on a platform, if you're stuck on the platform and they're coming up the ladders, you're just toast, you know? nothing you can do. There is the Pac-Man power pill in this. There's actually, I think, two per level, but the level hides them. So basically what happens is the platforms, they kind of look like logs to me. And as you're playing the games, part of the platforms, like, open up like it's a bridge or something, and when it opens up, you can no longer pass through that part of the platform. It's like locked off, which can also kill you. But when that part opens up, if you happen to be on the platform beneath of it, there's like a, I don't know, cheese slice or chestnut or something that's under that platform, and you can actually kind of climb up and grab it, and that gives you the power pill essentially from Pac-Man, and you can just run through all the enemies and destroy them, although they come back pretty quick. But it is a nice way to escape. But yeah, that's kind of all the game is. The only other parts about the level that change or alter as you're playing is that sometimes the ladders get broken, I guess, and you can no longer use them. The game's just hard, and I feel like there's not a whole lot of options or ways to maneuver, and it just gets harder when the platforms are randomly moving around and the ladders are randomly breaking. I guess the only good part about the game is it seems like once you beat a level, or maybe it's a point-based thing, but you can gain lives pretty quickly in the game, so that's good. The thing that I didn't like about the game, though, is that once you beat a level, it changes color palette completely in the next level, but the location of all the bird nests or houses that you have to build is the exact same, and all the platforms are the exact same.
Oh.
So it's pretty much the same. More ghosts or like bird enemies appear, but that's kind of it. It's just harder. So I was really hoping for some other levels, but it's pretty much just one level the whole way through. Just in a lot of different color palettes. But yeah, that's pretty much what the game is. I'll talk about my ratings for it now. Let's start out with the graphics, because that was the thing that really drew me to the game originally. I ended up giving it a 3.5 out of 10 for graphics, because everything's a multicolored sprite, and that's really cool. Even the platforms themselves, they have a thickness to them. They look like logs, which I like. I mentioned the birdhouses. They definitely look like birdhouses. The eggs don't look like eggs. I don't know what's going on with them. I guess maybe there's some sort of hidden timer in the game, and the eggs slowly crack, and I guess if they hatch, you lose. I don't really know what the thought process is there. We don't have a lot of backstory behind this game, but they all look good. Like, everything that you're seeing looks good. There is a black background behind everything, but I mean, Donkey Kong had that, and we rated that high, right? Like, I think everything that is in here looks really good. And when the color palettes switch, it's very distinct. Like, every single thing in pretty much in the level switches color, except for your mouse and some of the enemy birds. But it feels like a nice switch when the color palette changes happen. The birds themselves have some really nice animations and faces. They remind me of the Pac-Man ghosts a lot. You've got, like, red, yellow, and pink ones as the first starting three. And then an orange follows. So it's very much in that art style. I think the mouse looks a little weird. He just looks creepy, like the Chuck E. Cheese mouse. But you can definitely tell he's a mouse, and he's well detailed. And it's composed of three different colors, or three or four different colors. So, and well animated, again. He climbs up the ladders. So he's got like a back-facing sprite, and then also walking animations and all that kind of stuff. When you pick up the power pill, he does flash, like in Pac-Man, or when you have the Donkey Kong hammer. So that's fun, too. So I think everything looks good in the game. That wasn't, you know, the thing I was worried about with it when I was playing it. The gameplay, though, that was what I ended up not enjoying. I only gave it a 2.75 out of 10, because, my God, is it hard. It's like crazy hard. And I just felt like with all the platforms kind of like randomly opening and closing and the ladders getting destroyed, it was just not enjoyable. I felt like sometimes my deaths were RNG based. I kept trying to play and find like a route through the level that would be safe, but the birds act differently every time, or they start in different places or something. And you couldn't like plan out a route. You actually had to do active dodging, but again, when it's a 2v1 and there's only one or two directions you can go, it just wasn't it didn't feel like things were working out my way. So I didn't really enjoy it, and I thought, especially when I found out the levels don't change from level to level, I was like, man, that really sucks. So I didn't go high with this one. I think Pac-Man's better, I think Donkey Kong's better, I think Space Panic is better in terms of the gameplay. Moving on to sound effects, these sounds are pretty good, I thought. I give it a 3 out of 10. There's a lot of single note harmony music that plays. There's like a music tune that plays all the time in the background. There's one that plays when you win a level, one that plays when you die. Like all different little musical tunes, and they're nice. I like them all. There's like random normal sound effects at play, just like in the background when you like pick up a power up and stuff, and I found those to be quite irritating. You guys will hear them in a sec, but I don't know, they're just high pitched and I think there wasn't many sound channels, so I felt like the music was getting interrupted by other sound effects constantly. So I didn't think the sound was too good, but we do have a lot of music, so I ended up giving it a 3 out of 10 just because of that. For relevance, I only gave that a 3 out of 10. Pretty low for relevance. While I was hoping this is would be a well-known game, because I feel like I've heard the name Naughty Mouse before, I actually found out that the actual name on the cabinet is called Snatcher.
Oh.
And that Naughty Mouse is just displayed in the game's cabinet art, or like, it's displayed digitally in the game. So like, the name that was programmed in the game is not the name on the cabinet. It's also by a very small company, Aminip. And I wasn't able to find any videos of the actual cabinet on this one. It just doesn't seem like it's very well known. So the fact that we don't even really know what the name is or why there's like bird houses and eggs or any of that stuff, I couldn't go high with the relevance. And overall, I gave it a 3 out of 10. I think it's pretty solid. It's just not special. You know, like, we don't see many games like this, so I enjoy seeing these kind of platforming ladder games. But this one kind of felt like they were trying to make it Pac-Man, but Pac-Man only works because you're in a maze that has lots of different options when it comes to maneuvering around, and the power pills are very easily accessible. Like, if you need one, you can go to the corner, they'll always be there, and you can pick one up. And in this one, it's like, if a platform's not raised, you're screwed.
Right.
And that's just RNG, you know. So it just felt like this isn't the type of game to make it into Pac-Man. So yeah, it didn't really work, but I appreciate someone trying to do something new. And I think graphically there's a lot of nice sprites here. They have some character and are fun, so
yeah,
it was enjoyable to take a look at, but not a great one.
Yeah, I mean, well, with the theming and the visuals, like you mentioned, we had to do a review of it.
Yeah,
shame it wasn't great, but that's all right. There'll be more Donkey Kong, Pac-Man inspired things in the future, I'm sure.
Yep, I'm sure too.
All right, well, we have another review. We're kind of doing all our reviews in a row here. Second game that I took a look at today called Dam Busters, and that's like busting a dam that holds water, not like those Dam Busters. And it's by Southwest Research and Gamatron, and it's a scramble type game. We couldn't find a lot of information on this, but what I could find says that it was developed in the UK on a UK made board, and Gamatron was very proud of that fact and promoted it in their advertising. And they also said this is based on a British air raid against a dam in Germany or something like that, I think. But it was actually a real thing. So they said it's one of the first multi-stage games that is based on fact and not science fiction.
Like what, in the flyer?
Yeah, it said that in the flyer.
Got it.
So I don't know if this was an actual air raid that happened or what, but you do fly over the English Channel at the beginning of it because you're launching from the UK, I guess.
Okay.
But basically, yeah, it's a scramble type game, World War II bombing run in an English bomber. The gameplay, it's a scramble type game where, you know, you're scrolling to the right, you're bombing downwards and also shooting forward as you go. And there's a bunch of obstacles in your way. There are different stages as you fire. At the beginning, you know, you're passing over the English Channel and there's boats that you have to fire at. Then you're flying over Germany, I think, and there's like air balloons and turrets and enemy planes that you have to take out. And then you also have to keep an eye out for the periodic dams that show up, and they give you the most points if you blow them up. I couldn't really tell if there was much. It seemed like there was the English Channel level and then maybe two other levels, but I don't know. The distinction between them was kind of vague, because other than the water and flying over land, the visuals aren't too different. So there may be more levels. The hot air balloons, I know, didn't seem to show up until later. So that might be a like third or fourth stage. but you have the same kind of bombing thing we see in all these scramble type games where you bomb at a slightly forward downward angle. It's not straight down, and your machine gun fires forwards, but then, like we've seen in previous games like this, if you move up, it shoots diagonally up, and if you move down, it shoots diagonally down. So you can aim it in three sort of directions. And you can also control your speed in this, which is really interesting, and it actually controls the speed of scrolling too, which I don't know if we've really seen before. So you're not just moving like within the screen like you do in a lot of scramble games, but you can actually go faster. And if you go too slow, you can stall and crash. And then another interesting, unique thing about this game is that your plane actually has 6 points of damage it can take reflected by different parts of the plane. And they're abbreviated, so I don't know what they all are, but I know there was port one and port two, tail, flap, and then starboard one and starboard two. And it seems like some hits do 2 parts of damage, some only do one. I couldn't really tell if it actually reflected where you got hit, that like you actually took damage there, because I flew into a mountain and I got like port one and tail damaged. So I don't know, but it didn't blow me up instantly. But anyway, it's an interesting mechanic that there are different places you can take damage. I don't know if there's any way to repair, and I don't know if it actually affects how you fly, but you're not just instantly dead as soon as you get hit. There's also a fuel meter that seems to very slowly deplete, and I couldn't see a way to get more fuel, unlike other scramble games. And I think it's confirmed by the intro of the game that says when you run out of fuel, you have to put in another coin to keep playing. So,
oh no.
Yeah, they're taking out that skill-based refueling element of it and making it so, yeah, once you run out of fuel, sorry, you got to pay up. The British government wants your money. But that's the basic gameplay, you know, scramble game, flying, shooting things as you go, trying to blow up dams, hence dam busters. Let me get into my ratings now for this game. For graphics, I gave it a 3 out of 10. It is a pretty decent looking game. It's got nice, colorful landscapes with mountains that have snow peaks and colorful red and yellow houses, bridges, water on the English Channel with boats, castles, anti-air turrets, air balloons, lots of stuff to fly past. And the plane also looks pretty believable as a World War II bomber, which is nice, although it does just have one sideways sprite. The bombs and the bullets, like all of these games, drive me crazy because they're just like super tiny cubes that are hard to see. The explosions do look all right, though, which is nice. The background is a starry black sky, which I guess it's a nighttime raid, so it kind of makes sense, but it looks like you're in space at the same time, so it's a little confusing. And I do really like the enemy planes. They had nice turning animations and sideways sprites, and the clouds also looked really good, kind of like better than everything else on the screen, so it was a little confusing.
I liked when the bombs hit the water, they have like a water splash animation, which I really like.
Yes, yeah. Which I wish would happen more, because there's really only the English Channel section at the beginning, and maybe the dams as well, but yeah, that's a really nice effect too.
But yeah, I totally agree with you though, that the starry sky, I'm not a fan of it, man. I think a blue sky would have been better for this. Yeah. It doesn't feel like it's at night because all the clouds are bright white.
Yes. Yeah. Like some kind of gradient or something in the black sky might have made it look better, but it looks really weird. And as much as there are a lot of great looking elements in this, something about all of them coming together, like you said, the clouds with the dark sky and the bright green ground, it all just looks a little strange. So
the houses are like hot pink sometimes.
Yes.
Like, what?
Yeah, so it's a bit all over the place. That's why I kind of settled on a 3, because there's some elements that are really good, some elements that are just okay, and then altogether it's kind of like, I don't know what's going on, but it looks okay. So 3 out of 10 for graphics for me. Now, sounds, I went back and forth on this. I had to give this an NA because the MAME emulation says the sounds are working correctly. But almost every single sound in the game, I think every sound except for one, is directly from Galaxian, which doesn't feel right to me since they advertised that it was made on a UK-made board. But I guess they could have cloned the soundboard from one of the Namco arcade cabinets. So I'm not too sure, basically. And I wouldn't have rated it very highly if it was all Galaxian sounds anyway, so I'm just going to leave it unrated and leave it as an NA for sound. Moving on to gameplay now, I don't know if I just hate Scramble or what, but I did not like this game.
Oh no.
I gave it a 1.5 out of 10. Part of it, though, I think is definitely Dam Busters, not the Scramble genre. The shooting just kind of feels like off. The bombing had like no visual recognition for the most part, other than an explosion. Like the thing on the ground didn't change that much, so it was really hard to tell what I was supposed to be bombing. Because you can just drop bombs on all the innocent houses that are there and like nothing happens. I don't know if that was a bad thing or a good thing, you know, but I don't think it gives you any points. I think like the dam and the hot air balloons disappear and stuff like that, but I don't know. With the bombing, there wasn't much feedback. The enemy bullets were super hard to see and dodge, so I just felt like I got lit up and never made it very far in this game at all. And while I like the concept of different damaged sections on the plane, it didn't feel like it impacted gameplay at all. Like, I feel like if your one side's gone, maybe it should be harder to go up than down. Like, it just left me confused why it was these specific parts of the plane when it could have just been 6 hit points or something, you know? So I would have liked to see more impact there. Something I didn't mention is there is a visual change, though, as you take more damage, which I do appreciate. But it just didn't really translate to the gameplay. And just kind of combining all the things I didn't like with the jankiness of the game and the fact that when you run out of fuel, you have to put in another quarter or dime to keep playing, I just wasn't feeling it.
I also noticed on the MAME emulation, it's one of the only games I think we've ever played that requires 2 credits to start.
Yes, absolutely. So like they're getting you out the gate with this game and then who knows when that fuel runs out, but I'm sure it's not that long. So they were really trying to make money off this. And yeah, I wasn't vibing with it. Didn't feel super great to play. So 1.5 out of 10 for gameplay for me. Moving on to relevance now, I give this a 5 out of 10 because while we don't know a lot about the game, I do want to give it some credit for being like this UK made arcade machine based on a historical event. I think that's kind of cool, but it's not a super relevant game. It's a clone of a game that we've seen a lot of clones of before. So then overall, that left me with a 2 out of 10 for Dam Busters. It was unfortunately just mediocre. I wish I knew for sure what the sounds were, but I think I'd probably rate it pretty low, even if the sounds were what I heard in the MAME emulator. And it does have some pretty interesting and detailed graphics that I really like, but the gameplay just felt too unbalanced and off to me. So I liked some of the ideas that they had in there, but the execution was just lacking. So not my favorite, but fun to take a look at for sure.
All right. Well, I mean, we don't see lots of bomber type games. It was like Scramble at the same time, but I feel like it has some old school bomber vibes as well. It's kind of its own thing.
The theming definitely helps to be a Scramble kind of inspired game, but also, you know, changing it from sci-fi definitely makes a big impact on how it feels.
Yeah. So it is cool to see some non-sci-fi in here. So I'm glad we took a look at it.
Yeah.
Well, this next one was the last review of the day. It's Rock Climber by Taito, which came out in August of 81. And I took a look at it. It's another crazy climber type game. And nice. You know, I love my crazy climber games.
Oh, yeah.
And this one's by Taito, who we like, it feels like they rarely put anything out anymore.
Yeah.
So I was super excited to check it out. It's pretty weird, though. I'll be honest. It's like, it's a little different than I was expecting, maybe. I think the core elements are the same. I wasn't able to find an image of the cabinet, but based on how it controls on keyboard, I'm assuming it's the same double joystick setup where it's kind of like one joystick is for the arm for like the right arm and one's for the left arm. It was really hard to play on keyboard because it's not meant for that. So I didn't get too far in the game, but that's not why it's weird. The main idea of the game is basically Crazy Climber, which is where you were climbing up a building, dodging things that were being thrown out of the windows and whatnot. But in this game, you're climbing up a rock wall, I assume, although it's kind of hard to tell. I mean, you're definitely climbing straight up it, but there's like trees that seem like they'd be
right.
impossible to be placed in certain locations.
Perspective does look a little bit like you're crawling through the mud, but obviously yeah. you're supposed to be climbing.
Yeah, yeah. Towards the end, it does look a lot more like mountains because the sky opens up when you get close to the top, which is interesting. But I'll talk about that in a sec. But as you're climbing up this mountain, you're basically making your way through all these like trees, which are obstacles, just like static obstacles you have to dodge. There's waterfalls, which kind of spout water occasionally, so you can kind of dodge through them as long as they're not spouting water at that moment. And then a lot of enemies, which for the most part, the enemies don't really seem to chase you or attack you, really. They just kind of run around on screen for a while and then leave. But the enemies are crazy. You've got like monkeys, but then bears, which I don't even know if there's a place on Earth that has both those creatures together. You've got snakes. And then towards the end, you've got the weirdest thing. It looks like the sun with a face, like an evil face on it. And he like spits fire at you. And it's really cursed. I shouldn't say the sun. It's more like, I don't know, like Pac-Man, but he's a completely enclosed like capsule looking circle with like little limbs. He's very cursed. And there's even some sort of weird like satanic creature. I'm not really sure how to describe him. He's I don't know, he kind of looks like a dragon riding a cloud, but he's all red and he
okay.
like yeah, I don't know, the theming's all over the place for this. And there's also some birds and stuff, but it's mainly when you're playing it, it's mainly the monkeys and the bears, and the sun guy is always at the end who throws fire down. So that's the main things you're dodging as you're climbing straight up, pretty much. And what's interesting is that on the right-hand side of the screen is a mini-map, and in the original Crazy Climber, you had a mini-map as well, but it was kind of like your position relative to how tall the building was, right? On this one, they broke it down into two divisions. So it's like there's a left-hand side of the mini-map, and you have to climb from the bottom to the top of it, and then you appear at the bottom of the right-hand side of the mini-map, if that makes sense. By the time you get to that right-hand side of the mini-map shows these mountain peaks, and if you get to the top of each peak, you get some bonus points. You also get bonus points by picking up flags that are scattered around the level. But they're totally optional. But yeah, you can get to like three individual peaks before hitting that top peak, the third peak. And then once you hit the third peak, which is the very top of the map, you then play like what I'm assuming is like a lunar lander type game where you jump off with a parachute.
Oh.
And I was not expecting that part, but yeah, you jump off like with a parachute and you have to guide the parachute down. At the bottom of the mountain is like a cabin that appears. If you land on the cabin, you get a bunch of bonus points. But if you miss the cabin, no big deal. It just restarts. It's just like a bonus point stage. But it is a nice breather between the climbing that I was not expecting. And yeah, you just climb up again pretty much. I don't think anything really changes level to level, just more enemies. But that's all the game is. It's just more climbing, dodging of things, and jumping off the mountain this time when you're at the top, which is interesting. So with some pretty crazy enemies in here, one thing I did appreciate a lot, and I think this was in the original Crazy Climber as well, is that whenever you get hit and die, you will pretty much restart exactly where you left off. There's like no penalty. You don't have to start at the bottom of the mountain again, which was really nice. So I appreciated that. And I will say, even though there's a lot of enemies you have to dodge on this one, in the original Crazy Climber, all of the windows that you were grabbing were always closing, and not having to worry about that actually made it a bit more enjoyable, I think, for me. Like, it was hard for me to play just because of my keyboard setup, but I think this one would be a little easier than Crazy Climber, which, like, as soon as you get into Crazy Climber, the windows are closing and you're on a time limit, pretty much. But this one, there's a little bit more kind of warm-up. Like, maybe it starts with some enemies on the screen, but they're not really actually chasing you, so
right,
you have a little bit more time just to kind of figure out the controls and stuff, which was nice. All right, but with that being said, let me get into my ratings. I want to start actually with sound real quick because I had an NA that it's not emulated correctly and I couldn't find a video of the real cabinet. So I just had to NA it. Like, there were like Galaxian sounds in there, so obviously I couldn't rate that one. But let's talk about the other ones. Let's start with gameplay. For gameplay, I ended up giving it a 3.25 out of 10. I thought it was pretty enjoyable. It's not, I don't think, as fun as the original Crazy Climber, because in the original Crazy Climber, you had like four different stages that had completely new mechanics and enemies in them. And you also had some very notable bosses in the original Crazy Climber. And I don't think the sun thing is a particularly good boss. He just feels like kind of a normal enemy. But like the crazy weird ape guy in the original Crazy Climber, that was a boss. And they had their boss music and all that kind of stuff. And you just didn't really get that here. So it just felt a little bit more basic, you know, a little simplified and dumbed down, which I think for the beginning of the game is great because you're learning the mechanics of how to run up this wall. But it doesn't make the game interesting once you play through it once. It doesn't keep your attention like the original one did. So I enjoyed it, but it wasn't as good as the original Crazy Climber. For graphics, I ended up giving it a 3.75 out of 10. Even though the rock wall, the perspective doesn't look great, you have to give them credit. The whole screen is covered in a very highly detailed surface that they're trying to make it look like rocks. It's so much better than just having it be just a flat brown plane that you're running up, or a black background or something. You know, every single part of the screen is just full of color. And all of the enemies and your climbing dude are multicolored sprites. I do think some of the enemies look absolutely insanely weird, but you can't say that they're like drawn poorly or anything. And when you do see the sky at the top, when you get to the peaks at the top, because the rest of the mountain kind of fades away and you're at the mountain peak at that point, that is always very exciting because you're like, oh my god, I see some blue in this sea of brown. And I don't know, it just feels really good. So the mini map was a little confusing, but I think that works pretty well as soon as you understand what it's telling you. So yeah, I thought the graphics were really good. So 3.75 there. And for relevance, I gave it just a 5 out of 10. I was kind of like, you know, really felt like I was stuck in the middle here, where on one hand, it's Taito, pretty big company. On the other hand, it's like copying Crazy Climber. In fact, the climber himself looks like he's just straight up ported from Crazy Climber. They like didn't change him at all. And also, I couldn't find a video of the real cabinet for this. It doesn't seem like it was that popular. So I ended up just going right down the middle with a 5 out of 10. And overall, I gave it a 3.5 out of 10. It was pretty enjoyable, but I think I would still rather play the original Crazy Climber over this. But I like seeing it. I don't know how many more we're going to get because it doesn't really feel like it innovated that much. It's pretty much the takeoff from the top of the mountain, which was cool, where you kind of parachute down. But that's kind of the only thing they really changed about it. So, and just the location or the setting.
Yeah. But
it was still fun. I enjoyed taking a look at it.
Yeah. No, with, you know, it's got wild visuals and fun theming. I passed on taking a look at it because I thought I wouldn't like it. So I'm glad that you had a good time with it.
Yeah. I rated it a little higher. I want to give a shout out. I was doing research for this and I found this YouTube channel called Lord BBH. And he actually was playing this on Twitch, and the chat rated the game. They rated it a 1 out of 5.
Nice.
And he rated it a 1 out of 5 as well. But I just thought that was kind of fun. It's been decided by the people. But I think I liked it more than the average Twitch chatter.
Right. Well, cool. Nice. Glad you enjoyed it. At least, you know, a decent bit. And who knows? Maybe we will get some more Crazy Climber clones out there.
And we'll see what else Taito's cooking up. I mean, hopefully some original games too. Yeah. I would hope.
It's been quiet on the Taito front for too long.
Yeah.
All right, well, next we just have a few honorable mentions before we wrap up. We have a game called, I guess, Janputer, by Senritsu, which is the second highest grossing game in 1981 behind Donkey Kong, according to a 1982 Japanese magazine called The Game Machine. And it's a mahjong game. Not emulated, so we couldn't play it, but I guess in Japan, at least, it was very popular.
Mahjong's a big thing, man. People love it.
Oh, yeah.
There were a couple clones to Jamputer. We've got Jamputer by Taito and Jamputer by CLS. But that will do it for us today, so I hope you guys enjoyed today's episode. We are in August of 1981, and we took a look at some of the big arcade games that came out in August, including Armored Car by Stern, Naughty Mouse by Ominip. Dam Busters by Southwest Research, and Rock Climber by Taito. So I thought they were all pretty good. I mean, the day of the single color sprite is past us, Wes. I feel pretty confident saying that.
Oh, well, we'll see if you have to eat those words, but at least with these ones, yeah, we had some great visuals for sure. And always fun to take a look at. But yeah, if you enjoyed this episode, make sure to keep following us. We have a great website where you can look up tons of other information on everything we covered before. Lots of stuff about the developers and Stern Electronics among them, I'm sure. And you can also follow us on Twitter, where we post announcements about our episodes. And if you have any questions, feel free to send us an email.
And with that, we'll catch you next time.
See you all next time.